We're going to start the meeting because I intend, you might tell your friends to come in late, that we're going to vote on this bill at 2:25. Because we have to get it out of this committee this afternoon in order to get it to the Finance Committee. So I'm hoping that everybody will keep their discussions relatively short. And with that, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2680 to be recommended to be to pass and to be referred to the Finance Committee.
You're going to have to make that motion again.
All right. Happy Veterans Day. It's Veterans Day at the Capitol today. And, you know, this is a fun fact and a point of context. About 15% of those covered in general assistance medical care are military veterans in Minnesota. So this is the second time this bill has been heard in a Health and Human Services Committee, so I'm going to be more brief in my testimony and give you the top 8 reasons to support this proposal. First, it reduces the state deficit by $160 million. It assures ongoing coverage for those enrolled in Minnesota Care by keeping the Health Care Access Fund out of deficit. It captures roughly $100 million in federal funds by temporarily increasing the MA and HMO surcharges already in law. Fourth, it offers innovative reform in the care of the mentally ill, providing a savings to the state. Fifth, it offers health care to the roughly 70,000 Minnesotans for about half the price. Sixth, it provides health care cost containment as this proposal is funded within the Health and Human Services budget. Seventh, it shelters middle-class property tax and health insurance premium payers from increases that result from a steep increase in uncompensated care if we don't pass the bill. And eight, it reduces the state deficit by $160 million, which I think I already said, but I thought it would be important to say it one more time. My thanks to everyone who's worked on this proposal. It's been a labor of love. We've been working at it for many months. And even with many months of work, you know, there are still details to be resolved. I am really, again, grateful to the folks at the Department of Human Services. They've put in long, long hours over the last 2 months to produce for us a fiscal note on this proposal. And
Representative Murphy, we now have a quorum, so if you would call the meeting to order, and I think we'll do the minutes later. And so would you make your motion again on House File 2680?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2680 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. My final point is that I remain open to members of the committee from both sides of the aisle on their ideas to solve this problem. I have been since the start. I've been working closely with a number of you, and I just want on the record one more time my openness to others' ideas. Good. This is the Finance Committee, so I think it's important that we're talking about the money, and I think we should probably limit our conversation to that. I do have an author's amendment to get the bill into the shape that we would like it, and I believe that's the A2 amendment. Do you want to work on that now, or is there testimony you wanted to take first?
Let's hold off on the amendment.
Okay.
And we'll get the fiscal people first.
All right. I think John Walls was going to help us a little bit in understanding the fiscal note.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, all members should have a copy of the fiscal note in their packet, as well as having been delivered a copy of a one-page table that looks something like this that summarizes the much larger fiscal note. The fiscal note that you have in your packet is done to Senate File 2168. As of a point in time last week, they've made some additional adjustments to it today in committee. The fiscal note has a summary table on the front page which summarizes the effects of revenues and expenditures for 3 different funds: the general fund, the health care access fund, and a special revenue account that's created by the bill. It goes on in the first several pages to talk about, just give a little bit of a summary of each section of the bill, as well as the assumptions the department made in preparing the fiscal note, followed on page 9 by a summary of all of the fiscal impacts of each one of those sections in the bill. Mr. Chair, basically those provisions have been again summarized on the one-page table, which I'll go on to just talk about briefly and then answer any questions that that arise. So, Mr. Chair, if everyone takes a look at the one-page table that was delivered, should be in front of you. This basically just is dealing with the revenues and expenditures in the GAMC, temporary GAMC dedicated account. You can see in the top is the dedicated revenues, and it lists the revenues from the hospital surcharge, the HMO surcharge, dish revenue that's credited to the GAMC account, recoveries of third-party payments, recoveries of GAMC payments for people placed in federal programs, drug rebates, a transfer of the current law general fund money that is in the GAMC program but would terminate because the temporary program would go into effect before those dollars would run out. So those dollars are transferred into the dedicated account, and county grant reductions for mental health and some child services grants. The total revenue available, as you can see from the table, is about $142 million in 10 and $338 million in 11 for a total of $480 million for the biennium. Below that, you'll see just a summary of the dedicated expenditures. There is the temporary program itself. There are temporary rate increases for inpatient hospitals and mental health rate increases. There is some additions to Greater Minnesota Hospitals, a slight amount there. There's a maternity inpatient rate increase, temporary increase. There's an MAHMO temporary rate increase, and systems cost of $71,000. About two-thirds of the way down, you see the effect on this GAMC account that balances the revenues versus the expenditures. We start with a great deal of revenues, but not an equal amount of expenditures in for 2010, which gives us a balance of $96 million. In 2011, there is $11 million more in expenditures than there are revenues, and you can see this carries on through 12 and 13. The GAMC account, if I can skip forward to the last box on the page, there's just sort of a brief summary of what this is doing to the different funds. And there's a general assistance medical care account balance, which starts with $96 million account balance. Then expenditures begin to outpace revenues, leaving a balance of $84 million in 2011. That's further reduced as payments come in, but the revenues tend to drop off in 2012 as the program expires. In 2013, there is a balance remaining in this account of $30 million. And I believe there are some amendments coming forward that will further reduce this net balance in the general assistance medical general assistance Medicare account balance. But this spreadsheet shows that there are enough revenues to pay for the program in full. Mr. Chair, the next two lines in that box at the bottom of the page show what the health care account balance would be without temporary GAMC. It would go from a positive balance of 166 in 10 to a zero balance in 11, followed by large negative balances of 371 and 839 in 12 and 13. Those are the balances in the healthcare account, healthcare access fund, as per the November forecast. If this bill were to pass, the effect on the healthcare access fund would be the larger balance of 235 in 10, a positive balance of $94 million at the end of 11, and then because the temporary GMC program would go away if those if a permanent fix was not arrived at by the legislature, the account, the healthcare access fund would still go negative, but it would be a slightly brighter picture with smaller negative balances in 12 and 13. The other impact of this bill would be the general fund savings from the temporary GMC program, and this comes from basically three factors. As you can see, if the bill were to pass, there would be a positive impact in the general fund of $168 million in 2011 with additional revenues in 12 and 13. The primary change is $158 million savings to the general fund from a $110 million transfer to keep the healthcare access fund positive in 2011. This would not need to occur due to the healthcare access fund savings of not picking up the GAMC enrollees, as well as an annual $48 million transfer from the healthcare access fund to the general fund. That was slated not to occur because of the healthcare access fund projected deficit, but that would occur. That is the total of $158 million savings. In addition,
Mr. Wiles, that $168 million savings was not accounted for in the November forecast.
Mr. Chair, it was not.
Right.
And on top of those two transfers that would benefit the general fund by $158 million, there's an additional $10 million in the bill. It's roughly 9.8 or so additional savings to the general fund by postponing rebasing. I believe it's inpatient hospital rebasing. Through fiscal 2012, and that is primarily where the $12.9 million savings that you see for the general fund occur. Is there's a couple smaller impacts, but the majority of that is to the postponement of inpatient hospital rebasing. Mr. Chair, I don't know if that was all confusing to everyone, and if there's any questions, I'll try to answer.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Thank you. I appreciate reading the short novel. I'm a 27-page fiscal note. And actually, it was helpful having a little summary in the beginning to kind of see what the bill did, since we didn't cover all those details. But in terms of the money questions, can you talk about the HMO surcharge? It wasn't clear. I don't know what page that was on. It looks like one big plan is left out. We surcharge other plans inequitably, which may be an issue. That's not a money question, but can you explain to me how much comes out of that? It looks like, see, what page is that on? I just looked like it was a lot of money, and I didn't know if that was correct in the fiscal note. It's on page 9. Is that really $190 million almost on that for the biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe the Section 3 is the HMO surcharge, and it increases the surcharge to 4%. It's the current surcharge is 0.6%, and the department forecasted that is raising $193 million over the 2 years.
And then was there, Mr. Chair, was there an add back to $56 million that they get something to the good off that? Because I was reading else when there was some payment to the HMO, some increased rate or something that they get back.
Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there is an MCHA add back, which is in Section 29 of the bill.
Mr. Walls.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Did I not address the question? Is there something?
Well, no, so I mean, is that a reduction? Is that a reduction off of the net proceeds from the HMOs? So it would be like a net of $130 million or something? Are they related or are they unrelated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the department did not fiscal note something for Section 29. I'm assuming that's a net. I don't know if someone from the department wants to comment.
All right. It just seems like a lot of money, and I was just curious to understand it. There's so many moving parts here.
Just for the members, the idea was to raise these fees so we could capture federal money and then redistribute money back to the providers.
Right.
And the net of that is we get about $100 million of federal money. The difficult thing is that in order to abide by federal laws, we can't distribute it back any way we want. We have to follow certain formulas, and it's the formulas that lead to some institutions being more impacted than others, either positively or negatively.
Yeah. Right. Well, Mr. Chair, just to that point, and I guess it's about the money, but I was just trying to figure the net impact, and it seems like an impact of $190 million. Oh, Mr. Walls knows something. Okay.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, if you look at Section 29 in the bill, there are blank appropriations, and we have an amendment to fill, I believe there's an amendment to fill in some of those blank appropriations. That's why there's no fiscal note. When I referred to some of the account balance of $30 million in the GAMC fund after this, there was a net balance of $30 million in the temporary GAMC account. I believe there will be some dollars that may be going to that purpose to fill in those blank appropriations.
I must have got that off the amendment. That must be where I got the number from. But I was just trying to understand it. And
Mr. Chair. Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Murphy.
Thank you. And Representative Abler, I think the HMO surcharge is a lot like the hospital surcharge in that the HMOs contribute some money in, we're able to match that with federal dollars, and then they are repaid through their Medicaid rates. So they get money back in return through medical assistance, right? I think it's important, we haven't talked a lot about this, that we move the GAMC population out of the prepaid medical assistance program, again, to make sure that we're putting as much of the scarce resources that we have into care itself. There is comfort language in my author's amendment to deal with making sure the money that's going back to the HMOs is being used in medical assistance. And then just like the MA surge charge has some uneven distribution, that's one way to talk about it, so does the HMO surcharge have that same notable factor in terms of its distribution based on how much MA population they have. And so Mr. Walls is talking about an MSHA provision to try and balance that out, which we're going to deal with in the Commerce Committee. And I'm sure we'll deal with it here as well, but we're going to hear it also in the Commerce Committee.
And Mr. Chair, just as this goes forward, it might be helpful to the Commerce Committee especially and to us anyway, just to know what the impact on the different HMOs is net and see if that would be probably an interesting number to know, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Walls? Representative Broad.
Oh, wait, actually, I'm not sure who it's for.
Okay.
Mr. Walls maybe can help me, or he can tell me I need to ask somebody else. That's fine, too.
Leaving.
What I'm trying to understand related to that HMO surcharge is what percent of the insured population actually are going to be seeing that surcharge versus not seeing that surcharge? And if the surcharge is not applied across the board to all HMOs, I'm just kind of curious what percent of people are going to be foregoing that surcharge that's then shifted onto other groups. There's a quizzical look by Mr.
They're Bob. Discussing it. Mr. John.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I think at least for the first part of your question, the MSHA surcharge if there is a loss in the fund, it's assessed on, I believe all health plan companies based on their share of business or in proportion to the number of policies they sell. I'm afraid I don't know the details of the calculation for that.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chun, I guess what I'm trying to get at is the new HMO surcharge that new amount that's being put on. If it's not hitting everybody across the board, so I'm looking more on the front end than the back end. Mm-hmm. What percent of the people, I guess, are covered by the HMOs that are not paying the surcharge versus the HMOs that are paying the surcharge is, I guess, what I'm trying to get at. Does that make any sense? Well, I'll quit beating around the bush.
Yeah,
there's HMOs, from my understanding, that are exempted out of that surcharge. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to get at is what percent of the population is exempted out and what percent is going to pay.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danette Coleman. I'm with Medica. And just I think there's some confusion in what the question is being asked and what the answers are, because I'm hearing MA surcharge and I'm hearing MCHA.
Oh, no, I'm not.
And they're two. I know you're not asking that. So they're kind of two different parts of the bill. So I think what you're asking, Representative Broad, and please clarify, is your question is around, so who pays this additional MA surcharge, and then what populations, what groups would be included in that? Is that your question? Okay. So the additional MA surcharge is for the HMO business, and so it's going to vary from health plan to health plan depending on their makeup in the HMO. So some health plans have all of the HMOs, that's where they have their government programs. So that's kind of dictated through statute. So all of our government programs in the HMO for Medicaid. And then each health plan has different portions of the commercial membership in the HMO. So some health plans have a heavy number of commercial members in their HMO. Some health plans have very few commercial members in their HMO. So it's going to depend on that health plan's company makeup of their business.
I think we have HMOs do one form of insurance, and then we have regular insurance that are not HMO products, and you'd have to look at each individual health plan or Blue Cross Blue Shield, let's say, and find out what percentage of their people are in an HMO, what percentage of their people are in a regular insurance product.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I appreciate that, and maybe I guess it's less of a request for a numerical value then, in light of your comment, and more of a request for or a concern for fairness in terms of making sure that what we do is across the board. I think we've seen out in D.C. In the health proposal, there's some concerns that we're going to put a new tax on, and I would argue that this is a tax, but a surcharge tax, whatever. You're going to put a new tax on certain Cadillac plans. That's not exactly apples to apples, but I think the philosophy behind it is similar. But we're going to exempt out a big group of people. We're going to exempt out unions or whomever. And so I guess when I look at this, I'm just trying to get a sense for how disparate it is in terms of its fairness, in terms of how it's applied to the people across the board.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Broad, I think a great point. One of the things that is difficult about the surcharge is it's inflexible. One of the things that is positive about the surcharge is that it is blind to the nuances that our politics might move us to support or not support. So the surcharge has got to be applied the way the rules set it up, right? So it has the added feature of the added feature of inflexibility, but fairness in that it's applied evenly. But the outcome of it is giving people heartburn. Okay.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Walls, the MSHA side of the question that was just asked. I specifically just want just a quick 5-second explanation of what's going on page 35, section 29, lines 35 to 11 to 23. Can Mr. Walls just explain mechanically what's going on and what we're trying to do in that section, please?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I believe the problem that's trying to be addressed is that there were certain disparities. There's disparities in the way some hospitals are treated. There's disparities in the way certain HMOs were treated, and this was to try to sort of level the disparity.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it true that Health Partners has a very high percentage of their people in HMOs, and so if they're paying this tax, they're going to pay more than Blue Cross Blue Shield?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
I would comment that this is certainly not a perfect bill, but what we're trying to do is keep the GAMC program alive and capture as much federal money as we can. Representative Broad.
And Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the efforts. I really, really do. I think you, Representative Murphy, and many others have worked and toiled and pulled out many hairs, I'm sure, about how to make sure that we serve this population in the best way that's affordable. And so let me just tell you, I really do appreciate that, as do many others. One of the question I have is, and I don't know if it's Mr. Chun maybe that can help answer this, but how often do we put the name of an organization in our state statute books? We try to stay consistent along the way, and this just seems like a really curious approach. And I know we're trying to solve problems, and I appreciate that. How often does something like this happen related to the actual name in the books?
Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the more common approach, I think, as you know, is to identify an organization sort of generically without putting the exact name in by specifying various details. There are some instances, I can't remember exactly, for what organization, where names of organizations have appeared in, budget bills and the like. But normally, it's the most common practice would be to not identify specific names.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Chun, for that answer. I just hope Health Partners or whomever doesn't change their name. We'll be back at the drawing board here in our state statute books.
Okay, let's move on. And Mr. Chun, if you want to make your presentation on the MA surcharges.
Mr. Chair and members, you should have a one-page double-sided document in your packets. Be giving an overview of the Medicaid provider surcharges. Basically, provider taxes or surcharges or fees were initially approved by the federal government in 1985 as a way to give states more flexibility in how they raise their Medicaid funds. The way this works is that, in general, a provider tax or surcharge would collect revenue from a specified category of healthcare providers. The state would then use this revenue as its share of Medicaid spending and collect a federal match. And providers would then be made whole to varying degrees by an increase in their Medicaid payment rate or by other methods. So overall, the state is better off under this approach because it's really not made a general fund expenditure. It's raised its share from the provider, and then it gets the federal match. The extent to which a provider is better off or whether or not a provider is made whole depends on a number of factors. This could depend on the type of payback mechanism and also the percentage of a provider's revenues that are from Medicaid, since Medicaid is the payback mechanism. Minnesota first enacted its surcharges in 1991. This was a period during which there was a significant budget shortfall, so I believe that these surcharges were sort of a trade-off where we won't make further or deeper cuts in return for raising revenue through the surcharge. So these surcharge amounts and how they're calculated have been changed over the years, and a few of the surcharges have had increases in the amounts assessed. The current surcharges are nursing homes. There's a surcharge of $2,815 per licensed bed. For hospitals, the current level is 1.5% of net patient revenues, but you're excluding Medicare here. And the bill before us would raise this surcharge to 3.95% of revenues through September 30th of 2010. Then it would be reduced to 3.06% for October 1st, 2010 through June 30th, 2011. The current surcharge on HMOs is 0.6% of total premium revenue. As mentioned, the bill would increase this to 4% and also apply it to county-based purchasing plans. And there is an ICFMR surcharge, which is $1,040 per licensed bed. The rapid growth in the use of these provider taxes or surcharges by the states led the federal government to basically regulate their use. As one example of how common they are, NCSL figures show that for both fiscal years 2009 and 2010, 44 states and the District of Columbia use at least one Medicaid provider tax. So the initial federal regulatory legislation was passed in the early 90s. And generally, federal law prohibits states from getting a federal match from revenues raised by an impermissible tax. So in other words, federal law states that in order for the state to get a federal match, that it must be considered a permissible health care related tax. So under federal regulations, there are several criteria for when a tax is considered permissible. First, the tax must be broad-based, has to be imposed on all items and services within a class of providers. It has to be imposed uniformly, meaning that either the tax is the same amount for each provider, or if it's a sort of a per-bed surcharge, that amount is the same per bed, or it's imposed at a uniform rate on all services and providers in a class and all revenues and receipts. And then finally, the tax cannot violate the hold harmless provisions. In other words, the state can't somehow guarantee that a provider will be either paid back fully or made whole. And there are several criteria for when a provider is considered to be held harmless. These would be if the tax provides for a non-Medicaid payment positively correlated with either the tax amount or the difference between the Medicaid payment and the tax amount, or the Medicaid payment varies based only on the tax amount, or finally, a direct or indirect payment offset or waiver directly or indirectly guarantees to hold the provider harmless. There is a federal, I guess, safe harbor on this prohibition on sort of indirectly guaranteeing payment. Basically, if the tax is set at a rate that does not exceed 5.5% of total provider revenues from all sources, they don't apply this indirect prohibition. And then beginning October 1st of 2011, this threshold goes up from 5.5% to 6%. And I should just mention that this this percentage threshold that we're talking about includes all provider taxes. So in Minnesota, it would include the MA surcharge, the Minnesota Care provider taxes, and the Minnesota Care 1% premium tax. There are new federal rules that would regulate provider taxes that are scheduled to take effect July 1st of 2010. These were rules that were initially proposed by the Bush administration and were delayed by the Obama administration until this date. Among other things, these rules would make it easier for the federal government to rule that a tax provision violates the hold harmless prohibition. For example, the term positive correlation, as it's interpreted now, usually is evaluated based on a statistical or mathematical test, whereas these new regulations would sort of apply that in a broader sense, not necessarily a mathematical sense. So it's unclear at this time whether or not these rules will be implemented on July 1st or whether they'll be modified or delayed. There are also some limits on Medicaid reimbursement that would, you know, limit to the extent to which a provider can be held harmless from a tax by an increase in their Medicaid payment rate. The first would be the Medicaid upper payment limit, which basically it's a federal requirement that the aggregate payments to a class of providers cannot exceed what would be what they would be paid under Medicare. And this applies to providers as a group, so payments to individual providers within that could vary. There's also an individual provider charge limit where basically MA cannot pay providers more than the amount of their charges. Finally, for managed care plans, and I think we've discussed this before, the capitation rates must be actuarially sound. So to summarize, federal regulation of these provider taxes or surcharges has made it more difficult for states to make providers whole. The requirements that a tax be broad-based and uniform basically means that the tax has to be applied to all providers and all books of business, not just, say, Medicaid providers or Medicaid revenues. The main way of paying back providers is through increases in Medicaid payments. However, the hold harmless requirement, along with some of the Medicaid payment limitations, you know, sometimes make it difficult to do this. And finally, the possibility of new provider tax regulations is a source of uncertainty. And if adopted, it's thought that these would make it more difficult for states to pay back providers for their tax payments. If there are any questions, I can answer them.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair,
okay.
You'll all be conferred with a degree now in healthcare finance.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chun, I'm just wondering about the surcharge and how it relates to gross versus net in terms of how it's applied.
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, the surcharge, say in the case of the hospitals, it refers, or the language refers to net patient revenues. So you'd be excluding Medicare revenues, I believe would be the main exclusion. So on certain of these surcharges, there are some exclusions. For example, for the HMO surcharge, again, Medicare revenues are not subject to the surcharge.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chun, okay, so you take off the Medicare revenue, but essentially you're still dealing with everything but that. So if you have $100,000, just say a dumb number, $100,000 worth of revenue, and say 2% or 15% is Medicare, then it's essentially based on the gross revenue minus the Medicare portions of the revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that's correct. The surcharge would be based on, say, all of your revenues in this example except for Medicare revenues. So maybe that's, you know, 80% of your total revenues. The method of payback for the surcharge is normally based on your Medicaid payments. So if your Medicaid share of business is, say, 20%, it would be for those 20% of billings that the increased payments would apply. And that's where I think sometimes, in some cases, it's difficult to hold all providers harmless.
There is another complicating factor on this. I mean, the MA surcharge is on the providers, so everybody that gets served there pays is going to get counted. On the HMO surcharge, the self-insured corporations are getting a free ride.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
I'm just curious if we're going to be getting more money into the state from all the legal and accounting required for the gymnastics of the of this surcharge.
Representative Broad, I can say that they don't get paid overtime, but the fiscal staff and the people that work for us have been putting a lot of hours in to try to get this straight.
And Mr. Chair, I think it's important to reiterate, it's me, important to reiterate that we already have these surcharges in law. So we're increasing both the MA and HMO surcharge. So we shouldn't need a whole new raft of lawyers and accountants.
Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, to the when's the last time we added a surcharge in any of these areas?
Mr. Chair,
we did a nursing home one in 2003. Is that right?
That would be the latest increase. Yes.
Okay.
And that particular one only hits the private pay people in nursing homes. Okay, Representative Murphy, do you want to give us your amendment? Oh, wait a minute. Or do we want to have? Yeah, let's hear from. We have two people signed up to testify. They get about 3 minutes apiece, and then we'll deal with Representative Murphy's amendment. And Ms. Abderholden, would you state your name for the tape, and we'll give you about 3 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. We do understand how difficult it's been to find the money to restore the GAMC program. We do support the bill. We understand you've been, you know, really between a rock and a hard place. And we do appreciate your hard work, but we just need to say that we feel like we're forced to choose between two things that keep us alive. One is mental health treatment and medication, and the other is community services. We appreciate that there's going to be a decrease in the amount of money being cut out of adult mental health services and the children and community services block grant. We do appreciate that. But I just want to remind you that those two funds fund community support programs, crisis services, supportive housing, case management, children's day treatment, and residential. And I just want to make sure, just for the record, that you know that this will impact the people that I represent. I know that the options are just not great out there, but I would be remiss in my responsibilities as an advocate for people with mental illness to not let you know that it's not going to be easy to take those cuts. We would prefer that the sacrifices that need to be made by everyone, and not just the poorest and the most vulnerable in our society. NAMI has always supported raising taxes, put money on the alcohol tax, you know, anything, to try to mitigate the cuts that have to be made. I just want to say that our mental health system is fragile, as are the people that are served by it, and just to remind you that over 550 people died by suicide in 2008. So this is, you know, for some people, their lives are on the line. Again, I appreciate the hard work, but I just needed to let you know that while I appreciate that the cuts are a little less than before, it's still a cut. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Abderholden. And I would say mentally ill population, it's very difficult to separate what's a social service and what's a medical service. For upper middle class people, it's, for most of us, it's pretty clear what it is. But for this population, if you don't have a home, what difference does it make if you got a doctor? So any questions for Ms. Abderholden? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not so much a question, but Ms. Abderholden, first of all, thank you for being here and continuing to speak up for the people that you do speak up for. And, you know, I just want to say to you, and I guess to everyone, that, you know, this isn't our first choice. We also, many of us, I guess I should only speak for myself, but I certainly believe that we should do this in a more fair and more transparent way. And we're going through all these different gyrations and formulas and all the things that Representative Broad is concerned about, that there might be a lack of fairness. That is thrust upon us by the need to get the governor to sign something, because we know that he will refuse to do it what we consider the right way, the transparent way, the way that people can understand, the way the public can understand. And, you know, I regret that we have to try to do it, but it's kind of, we're really between a rock and a hard place, and I hope that everyone understands that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and we do. I guess there's a saying in my, you know, kind of community organizing that if you get hit by the bus, you should scream so you don't get hit a second time. And so I just wanted to let you know that we've been hit, and hope that you don't come back a second time.
Well, thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Next, we'll go to Patricia. What? Oh, Broad? Representative Broad had a question. Nope. Okay. Patricia Caldwell from the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Patricia Coldwell with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thanks for the opportunity to talk briefly here today. I just want to comment also on the transfer of the Children's and Community Services Act funds and the Adult Mental Health Integrated Fund. That is on page 7 of the fiscal note and Article 2, Section 2 of the bill. And some of these comments will repeat what I said to the policy committee last week, but I want to comment on the new information that I think is in the amendment you haven't heard yet, so I hope I'm not scooping Representative Murphy here a little bit. But first, I do want to say that counties do acknowledge the inevitability of a county contribution as part of the GMC solution. This is because counties recognize that they would incur some costs if GMC funding were eliminated. And our view is that reductions to the CCSA grant and the adult mental health grants are a better alternative than the cost share that was originally proposed in the bill when it first came out, because it doesn't create this assumption, however temporary, that counties are responsible for health care costs, a percentage of health care costs for low-income people. We also appreciate it. I know you haven't heard a lot about this yet, but that the amount that counties are expected to contribute through the grants is about $10 million less than the $29 million originally proposed. One of our principles was that while we recognize that counties have some exposure and some liability, we did not think that we should be liable for a greater amount than what we'd be responsible for if GAMC went away. And this puts us somewhere in the ballpark, we think, in terms of our estimates of the amount that we think we might be liable for. Perhaps a little high, but there are some law enforcement costs that we hadn't been able to get a handle on. That said, we do believe the reductions will have serious implications for those served through the CCSA grant and the mental health fund. And since Ms. Abderholden talked about mental health, I won't really say a lot more about that. I think you do know that CCSA is a block grant that comes to counties and primarily these days is used for child protection. So it's really the loss of some of this funding will limit counties in their ability to respond to child maltreatment as well as elder abuse. And those reductions do come on top of the governor's unallotment last summer of $16.9 million in 2010 and $22 million in 2011. So I know you have a difficult choice. I guess as I would just say, as you face more difficult decisions in the budget for the rest of the session, please do your best to ensure that counties are able to maintain a safety net for vulnerable children as well as vulnerable adults. And then the other comment that I wanted to make, it's a little bit outside of my scope and yours too, but the fiscal note doesn't indicate any cost to counties for eliminating GAMC funding for county jail inmates. We don't have good statewide data on these costs, but we know that Hennepin County has estimated an $1 million increased cost from that change. And then in addition, if more individuals are jailed due to lack of medication, that there'll be additional corrections costs as well. In spite of many unpalatable elements, our association does believe this bill is a better option than eliminating GMC funding. As I did indicate in my testimony last week, counties would have preferred that the funding reduction would come from county program aid. We do accept, kind of trying to understand that that's not an option for the House at this point, but we do hope that as more difficult budget decisions are considered later on this year, that the legislature will work across committee jurisdictions to try to look at how to best align the resources and manage the budget reductions in ways that make the most sense for people you serve. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Caldwell. I, too, was compelled by your testimony in our policy committee when you, I think you termed it like a Sophie's choice, that we have to make these types of choices in terms of who gets cut. I do want to make sure, though, that we understand on the MCC, or the Child Community Service Act folks, that's our children. Those are our kids, and so though I can appreciate your philosophical approach to not wanting to have a cut to or for the counties to assume responsibility for this population in perpetuity, and that we make cuts in other places in order to make sure that we don't do that in the future, you have said, and there's even and I agree that this group has been cut over and over again. And so I often hear us talk about, we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, And this is robbing little Susie to pay Paul. This is robbing our children to some extent to pay Paul. And I just really, really have hard time. I really have a hard time with us kind of having to make that choice with the most vulnerable group that we have, which is even more vulnerable than the population in which I care so much for, which is this general assistance Medicare, which is our children. And so to that end, I know that we have tough choices and we have to move forward, but I want to be really, really clear that the cuts that we're going to make to our children, the most vulnerable children, the ones that don't have a voice, I hope we don't come back here next year with some really, really sad stories because we made that choice. Thank you.
Chair Huntley, Representative Hayden, I share your concern.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Caldwell, and now we'll go
Broad.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know when you want me to ask this question of the department, but I do have a question, an additional question for the department related to the FTEs included in this fiscal note.
Why don't we do that now? Is anybody from the department here talk about FTEs? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Greenman.
Thank you. Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Greenman, I guess when I look at fiscal notes, I'm always intrigued by the number of required individuals that get added in to various departments. And I know that the department has been growing in terms of its size along the way. And mm-hmm. I'm just a little curious why shifting a program or changing a program requires an FTE for federal compliance, requires an FTE for uniqueness of the GAMC program. It requires an additional FTE for coordinated care delivery options, for establishing different rates. I mean, it just seems like there's a lot of additional staff being put into place at a time when we just don't have the dollars for additional staff. I mean, to be blunt, I'd rather the dollars go to serve the people that we're trying to keep served. And I just want to find out why the need for all these additional FTEs.
Okay.
Mr. Greenman.
I can't speak specifically about a lot of these. I put the fiscal note together, but these are various FTEs throughout the healthcare administration. As you can see in fiscal year 11, there's 9.25 FTEs, and then there's 4.25 going out from there. The 4.25 FTEs are related to the mental health consult provision in the bill in Section 1 and I believe Section 12. And that has to do with providing prior authorization, providing additional mental health services. And there is somebody from the mental health division who could perhaps speak a little bit more about that. The other five positions are one-year positions for related to the to both the new GMC program and to administering the a lot of the changes in the surcharges. A lot of the changes we're making to finance this are fairly complicated, and they involve interactions with federal law, and in particular, the federal compliance piece has to do with making sure the payments we make, the increases we make to the hospitals are within their upper payment limit. We always have to watch that each year because we can't, if we increase payments to, there's a Medicare upper payment limit in federal law, and if we increase our payments above the Medicare upper payment limit, we don't get a federal match on that money. And that's just one piece of what this position would do. They also need to track payments that we get for DISH money. We're getting additional DISH money in this bill, or we're capturing DISH money through GAMC expenditures. We need to count some of the certified public expenditures that are in the bill. There's also and the rate adjustments that need to be made. That those need to be, we need to keep track of the rate adjustments, and also one of the things we have to do in the bill is if the, it looks like the expenditures for this new GMC program are going to exceed the amount of revenues we have, we need to adjust the rates that we pay in the bill to keep them within the payment, or they within the within the amount of resources we have available. We do that on a quarterly basis. Some of the other FTEs have to do with the coordinated care delivery system, which is in the bill. That's something that we don't currently administer. One thing I would say too, if I could step back for a minute, is right now most of the GMC program is through managed delivered through managed care. So much of the work gets done by the health plans. This is switching it all to fee for service. So we need to, it's a lot of the role that the health plans have paid, we're now playing in terms of consumer protections, watching to ensure that the benefit design for people is appropriate, that especially through the coordinated care delivery system, making sure that whichever counties are doing this, that the benefits are appropriate to the people, that they're being funneled to the right place. We also need to make sure that because the rates are being adjusted quite a bit in the bill, and there's some providers are going to have better rates for delivering inpatient hospital services than outpatient services, we need a position to make sure, well, one of the roles that one of these positions would play is making sure that people aren't getting inappropriately placed in an inpatient hospital setting when they should be getting placed in a lower cost outpatient setting.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to do your amendment, which addresses some of the things we just discussed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Just briefly on that. I mean, thank you for the explanation. Don't we have someone doing monitoring dish payments right now?
I think this is for, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen. We do. I think what we have is a very small staff doing a lot of this work. This bill adds a lot more responsibilities around the dish payments, around the federal upper payment limits that we don't currently have staffing for.
And Mr. Chair, similar on Medicare upper payment limits, IGTs, certified public expenditures. We have people doing that work already too, right?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
When we saw the preliminary fiscal note, we had, I and some of the folks from the Department of Human Services had a conversation about this, and I think the staffing complement is high, it's rich, but so far I have lost that battle, and maybe with some help, we will right-size that. I appreciate it. I will say that one of the things that was brought to my attention is the staffing complement that works on the interaction on the federal payments is small and preparing to retire. So I do think we should probably take that into consideration. But in some fashion here, I think we probably have a richness in terms of the FTEs that we can deal with. That's my perspective.
Okay. Representative Murphy, the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have a number of amendments to go through, so I'm going to be brief. And I have Mr. David Godfrey here in the audience, and Mary Krinke is in the audience. If we have questions specifically about the formula, the hospitals, or about the intergovernmental transfers in this amendment, because they'll be able to explain it more clearly and succinctly than I. But basically, the A2, which I'd like to move the A2 amendment. It has
moved the A2 amendment.
Thank you. It has clarifying language assuring interdisciplinary care in the mental health reforms. It has clarifying language regarding payment rates in PMAP as GMC is going forward in fee-for-service and being moved out of PMAP. It has language dealing with the surcharge, as I mentioned, and the intergovernmental transfer for Hennepin County and regions, which we can get into. So you understand how those work, that they are decoupled from the quarterly payments. They don't have interaction with the quarterly payments. They don't affect the other hospitals. that is another way to draw down federal dollars to help us out. And then there are changes to the county block grant, as promised. We promised we would reduce those county block grants if there was money in the bottom line. When we saw the fiscal note, there was, and so we in the amendment, there's language to reduce that block grant by about $10 million.
Representative Hush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and first I want to thank Representative Murphy for all the hard work she's done on this bill. I know with everything before us, it's been complicated and a long road, but desperately needed. I'm going to do an oral amendment. We've talked about the different grant programs, the CCSA grant and also the adult mental health grant, and this is tough for me because either way, it's difficult issues that we're dealing with, and we shouldn't be cutting either of them, in my opinion, but we do need to try to equalize things out, and our delivery system for child welfare services in Minnesota, we're pretty unique in Minnesota because we provide the least amount of state support of any state with the exception of, I believe, Indiana when it comes to child welfare funding. So essentially what my amendment is going to do is to equal out the reductions between the adult mental health grant and the CCSA grant. And these are temporary reductions that will be restored in 2012 and 2013. So the technicality of my oral amendment will be to be on line 710, delete the 14 million number and insert $9,560,500. On line 712, delete the 14 million number and insert the same 9 million number I just mentioned. On line 716, delete 5 million and insert the 9 million number I mentioned. And on line 718, delete 5 million and insert the 9 million I mentioned. This still is the same reduction as what's in the author's amendment. It is still a reduction that is less than the original bill, and it reduces both grants by an equal amount.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'll accept that amendment.
Representative Murphy incorporates that oral amendment into the A2 amendment. Any further discussion of the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The A2 amendment is adopted. Next, we have Representative Bunn has an A10-260 amendment. Separate. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It was one that was passed out separately. It wasn't in your packet at the beginning of the hearing, so it might just be lying in your pile. It's a one. I'm a one-paragraph amendment. Says appropriations hospital grants in line 1.3. Mr. Chair and members, this is an amendment to address an issue that was raised in the policy committee last week. Mr. Robert Stevens, the CEO of Ridgeview Medical Center, testified to us last week about the predicament faced by 57 hospitals around our state, mostly community-based hospitals, mostly small hospitals, mostly rural, mostly non-system hospitals, that under this GAMC proposal with the particular surcharge approach to it would lose considerable revenues under this bill and actually be much worse off than they would have been in many cases than if they had not had any GAMC fix. These hospitals understand the need to move forward with this type of legislation to address this issue. They also understand that they need to share part of the effort in supporting this issue and do not expect to be kept harmless. They also, in most cases, pay the DSH payments as well and do know also that they would have to support in this effort and bear part of the burden, though. As was heard in testimony last week, though, some of these hospitals would lose two to five times what they would have lost just losing GAMC itself. In some cases, that would be 40 or more percent of their net operating revenues if that occurred. It's a very large hit to these hospitals. These hospitals haven't have the makeup of their mix of patients at their hospitals out of no choice of their own. It just happens to be because of where they are geographically located that they have a mix that does not involve too many GAMC patients. And so this is just something because of their geography, and yet they are absolutely essential community-based hospitals. We have them in Patty Fritz District, my district, Representative Dean's district. Also, this bill would address things like in Representative Ruth's district, situation there. It's not going to, it's just going to mitigate the effects of the impact of this, but not, like I said, hold anyone harmless to this. The approach taken here is this to, because of the federal rules around the surcharge formulas, the approach taken here is to take $8 million from the general fund to be reallocated under a criteria worked out between the commissioner and the hospital association to some subset of these 57 community-based hospitals in order to address this mitigation issue. The amount of money indicated here, as of end of last week, would have been a much larger figure in the 15 to 20 million range. Because of some changes that occurred through the author's amendment, this number has gotten much lower. That's necessary to do some mitigation here. The author has been fully informed of this approach, and I believe she can comment in her own words, is supportive of taking this approach today. The Hospital Association also supports this amendment today. So again, it's just a way to once again try to, as has been attempted through other initiatives that's already contained in the bill, to mitigate, to increase the fairness of how this works. And this is an additional attempt to do that for these small community-based hospitals. So I hope that I can rely on all of your support today to make sure that these community hospitals are not unduly burdened by this very important initiative going forward that they do support.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am aware of this amendment, and I appreciate the work that Representative Bunn has done on bringing this to my attention and working with the Hospital Association. I'm not in love with this idea. As I said before, the MA surcharge is inflexible, but it's also blind, and that blindness is a measure of fairness. I also understand that there are a number of members who have hospitals that are concerned about the surcharge, its impact on their ability to do their work. And so with that, I will reluctantly accept this amendment, although I do want to let folks know that I'm going to be looking carefully at the amount. I'm going to be looking carefully at what this means in terms of the federal regulation. And I want to make sure that if we are doing some sort of granting, that it is for a purpose that advances our work in caring for the underserved population. And so I'm going to continue to work with Representative Broad on those items.
So Representative Murphy incorporates the A-10 260 amendment into the A-2 amendment.
Can we vote on the amendment?
No, we can't do that.
Can't do that?
Yeah, we already passed it.
Oh, we already did the A-2. Yeah. Okay, so
Mr. Chair.
Sorry about that. Representative Abler has a question.
So I just have a question and maybe a friendly amendment that the author would accept. This comes out of the general fund. The surplus mm-hmm. is in the special revenue fund. This bill is very much a work in progress. And I think it's a placeholder for some relief to these hospitals. So I think that's a nice idea, and as this goes forward and the buff and shine of the process may help. Perhaps the author would, South Country stands to lose almost $1 million, I guess, under this situation. And so if the author would accept after the word hospitals on line 1.5, yeah. And also on the same line that later, just insert or county-based purchasing units, at least that way it gets a placeholder so they could apply and not go out of business over this fix. I would actually move that. So on line 1.5 after hospitals and after the hospital on line 1.5, I would move to insert or county-based purchasing units and hope the author will call that friendly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, let's go to Bunn first, sir, amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had anticipated this amendment, and so I don't know what the fiscal impact of this would be in terms of whether the $8 million or any other figure would be adequate to address mitigation, including those areas. So if there's anyone in the room that could speak to that, I'd be glad to hear that. But I also certainly would want to hear from the author of the bill as to whether this would be acceptable to her or not.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like the courtesy of time to think about that before we vote on that. The difficulty with trying to, we're not even restoring GAMC. We're creating a temporary program that is about half the price of the current program. We're using a funding mechanism that is inflexible. And if we're going to use countless pots of money to try and balance that, we're going to quickly lose the funds that we're trying to raise for care. And so I would like the courtesy, if it would be okay with Representative Abler, to think that through and its impact before we move that today.
Okay, so we'll temporarily put this amendment on the table, and we'll move to
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I was unaware of the $908,000 hole in South Country before today, and I know it's the author's intent not to put healthy county-based purchasing groups out of business. And we've had little chance to chat about any of this, and this amendment came up today. And I read it in my email, but I'm not even sure if there's a number in there. Just to the merit, to the size of the amount is $8 million sent to whomever for whatever purpose. It's not meant to be a hold harmless. It's a it's a pot of money to defray the pain. I didn't bring this forward as a gotcha thing to have South Country versus who loves and who doesn't love them. And so, and I'm willing to, this is not a political exercise for me. I don't have six more groups to add in who may suffer harm. But I'll withdraw the amendment that I brought forward. But this bill needs a ton of work. And I hope that, and you've bitten off more than you imagined, and there's more to come, I'm afraid, good colleague. This is one example of what we have to make sure we don't do in fixing one thing to cause some harm to others. And it wasn't even meant to illustrate that. It was just an effort to help South Country, who's, I think, a stellar example of how to do it. So I'll withdraw the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then we're back to the 810-260 amendment. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
So we have adopted the A10-260 amendment, and now Representative Abler, you have A3.
Oh.
And we don't have a lot of time.
Mr. Chair, we heard this. There's an amendment to the amendment, which
if the committee would accept that. This is I brought this forward in the policy committee, offered it, withdrew it. It has to do with the commissioner establishing a plan about accountable care organizations. In talking with Mr. Godfrey, representing Hennepin County, which would be probably the one who wants to do this, he had some technical advice, and that's in the amendment A5. And so if I could offer the A5, Mr. Chair, and incorporate that into my amendment, if the committee agrees that that's okay to make those changes at a late hour.
Let me ask you a question about the are you calling what Hennepin County is going to do in this bill an accountable care organization?
Yes, Mr.
In this bill an accountable care organization?
Yes, Mr. Well, what they'd like to do, or they would get 60% of the money and what was managed it. And
we chose not to use accountable care organizations for a very particular reason, and we changed that from the original bill to...
What do you want to call it?
Ms. Sales?
Care coordination partnership, something or other like that. Here's the deal, on, Mr. Chair, if you will. We stepped away from the idea of an accountable care organization because it is an idea that's being debated and has been debated in the federal government, in the federal reform bill. What is different between what has been proposed in our bill and the idea of an accountable care organization is about outcome measurement. And because we're doing a 16-month temporary program, to try and use that idea of an accountable care organization fully fleshed in 16 months is probably pretty impractical. So we took the idea of accountable care in terms of here is some funding and here's a population. And if you work with, especially, and this same idea is embedded in Representative Dean's bill, if the healthcare providers and the human service providers work in shared purpose with a vulnerable population, can we keep people healthier and out of the hospital? And I think there's a lot of support for that idea in this legislation. But I think, and as you proposed your amendment last time, you talked about using the idea of an accountable care organization for this population and studying that. And I think that's a fine idea. But I don't think we can move forward with that idea of a full-throated accountable care organization for a 16-month pilot or a 16-month temporary program. It's not even a pilot. Temporary program, because we won't, they just aren't the same thing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler.
What do you want to call it?
Well, we are in the bill that they're called coordinated care delivery option. And if you want to change the name, I'd be very happy and I'd support your amendment.
I'd like, Mr. Chair.
And we will be dealing later in about a week on accountable care organizations.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move that we change every reference to that accountable care organization to what you said. And I'll incorporate that into my motion. And members and Representative Murphy, this is actually for the department to come back with a plan. And I think at the end of the 16 months, you're going to really want some kind of a plan. And I think this has got the support of many people in this room. And I think that as a placeholder language already has been improved a bit, I hope you can accept it and just let it go forward.
And Mr. Chair, we already have the idea of the county coordinated demonstration pilot or whatever. I can't remember it, right? In the bill, right? For 16 months. I think what Representative Abler is attempting to, if I can speak my thinking through, is we successfully get a bill passed and signed into law for 16 months for DAMC. But we still have a vulnerable population that we need to think about in terms of the future and future reforms in delivery and payment and our public programs that we have to tackle. So the final word on general assistance medical care does not end if we're successful with this 16-month temporary program. And we're going to have to begin again in thinking about how we're going to sustain care for this population going forward. And I think Representative Abler is trying to tackle that and put us to work on that front. And if that is the case, then I support the amendment.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just procedurally, I'm not sure where we are because I think what Representative Abel, are we on the A3 amendment?
A5.
A5. Okay, what I understood was
I incorporated 3-5 on yours.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it was my intention to, if the committee will accept the technical changes which didn't meet the deadline, to accept me to incorporate those into the amendment, I would like to move the A5, incorporate that into the A3, as well as incorporate the Huntley oral amendment, which I'm calling friendly, even though I can't repeat what he said it was, because I like the fact this can go forward. So it would be my intention that you have an amended A3 as amended by Hennepin County before you, and I'm done.
Okay, any further discussion? So we're now going to vote on the A3 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. So we have adopted the Abler A3 amendment as amended. Did you have another one?
Yeah, let me phone a friend. Mr. Chair, would Representative Murphy yield? Do you want to do this A4 or not? Mr. Chair, I have no more amendments.
Okay, so then we'll move on to Representative Gottwald's A1 amendment. And I will say his amendment applies to Minnesota Care in general and not specifically towards the GAMC population.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, Representative Huntley is correct. The chair is correct. However, this is another way to look at things. And I don't know if I share others' frustrations with this, that we sometimes look at things as either or, and we only get two options. And I hope this illustrates that there may be other approaches to generating the revenue necessary to take care of the people we're talking about. The general assistance medical care population deserves better than the current general assistance medical care program, which, as Representative Murphy, and I have a lot of respect for the great work you're doing. I mean, this is tough work that you've been doing just to keep it going for another 16 months. But there are ways that we can look at driving the revenue necessary to take care of them for now and into the future. And I think it requires a bit of a paradigm shift that's represented at least in part by this amendment that I'm offering. So this is a source of revenue to care for the general assistance medical care population, if you will. We could certainly use it for other things, but in this context, that's the reason I'm offering this amendment. As you take a look at it, and some of the handouts are going around right now, this amendment takes an approach of a defined contribution, a defined state subsidy for purchase of private coverage under Minnesota Care for children and adults. This could also be used to help offset the recipient's expenses under an employer-covered health plan, if they have access to that. So the contribution can be used to purchase a basic health plan, can be used to pay their share of employer-based coverage. It is scalable. The state of Minnesota can decide what it can reasonably afford to continue paying as its contribution towards helping people obtain reasonable basic health care coverage, which is the intent of programs like Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care. Section of the amendment talks about a third-party administrator to administer the defined contribution. We utilize the state's already licensed and trained insurance agents, these people whose job it is to find people appropriate health care coverage, to help assist in this process. Those denied coverage through standard underwriting go to MCHA. The Health Care Access Fund makes MCHA whole, and savings from this program, again, help to make that work financially. I see a lot of furrowed brows, some smiles, and some question marks, and that's great. But that's part of what new thinking does. There will possibly be some federal waivers necessary, and that kind of gets us to the tail of the bill. The bottom line is we've taken a look at this, and this could drive as much as $350 million per year savings from Minnesota Care. And we can decide what we want to do with that money. Now, even if I'm only half off, that's a completely different way of looking at things, where we don't have to borrow from Susie to pay for Paul, right? I mean, that's the thinking behind this. Now, this is not full-fledged, and so, Mr. Chair, I am going to withdraw the amendment. But this is the kind of thinking that we can use to start helping meet these kinds of needs, both short and long-term. And I welcome any of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle. Representative Murphy and I have kind of had a passing conversation about this, but would love to connect with them and talk about these kinds of ideas and how they could help us meet needs now and into the future in a sustainable way and without necessarily raising taxes. This is reform.
So Representative Gottwalt withdraws his amendment, and Representative Gottwalt, in the perfect world, there's a guy named Ezekiel Emanuel wrote a book, and he proposes phasing out Medicare, phasing out medical assistance, and just putting people in the regular health insurance market and subsidizing theirs, and I would not be opposed to that. Okay, so we're on the final bill, and it's 25 after. Is there any further discussion? It's Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just want to thank Representative Murphy for her work on this bill. And in moving forward, I think that we all share the same goal of trying to get the right care to these people at the right place at the right time. I also think that we need to do it correctly and that we need to get it right. And my concern is with the financing that we have, that we're not getting it right. We've only received the fiscal note for this. Some folks got it yesterday late. Some folks didn't even get it today. So we really haven't had a good chance to understand exactly how this works. I think another concern that we have is fairness, and I think that that was brought out. We want to make sure that we get it right and we do it fairly. And I think that we need a little bit more time to understand exactly what the impacts of this are from hospital to hospital, city to city, and person to person. I think that nationally there is a great distrust for the imposition of large health solutions on not only vulnerable patients but vulnerable taxpayers as well. We applaud the effort and the forward direction. However, we also want to make sure that we do so in a way that is fair, open, transparent. And I'm just thinking that maybe that we're moving this a little bit too quickly. This looks like it wants to hit the floor next Monday. I feel like, particularly from folks on our side of the aisle, that we would like to have a little bit more of an opportunity to step back and take a deep breath and say what are really the impacts of this, where are the dollars coming from as we move forward. Something that we want to work with you, Representative Murphy, as you continue to do this, but I just want to, in the last minute here, just voice those concerns and also offer to work with you through the week, but also caution that we are moving, I think, quicker than we need to be quick moving, and I think we want to get it right the first time. So thank you for your work, and we look forward to the week ahead and the month ahead and months ahead.
I would just say that this bill will go to the full finance committee, and then it will go to the commerce committee, and then it will go to the tax committee before it gets to the floor. So there's lots of time for people to weigh in, but I really do want to thank the committee for keeping it short today. So Representative Murphy, any final comments?
I want to thank everybody. Thank you very much for the hearing and for your ongoing work on this effort. This is a big effort by a lot of people in the room and people that aren't in the room, and I really appreciate everybody's questions and their thought. I still remain confident that we can do this session for Minnesotans, and we should. Thank you.
So Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 2680, as amended, be approved and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment does succeed, and I think the bill passes. And excuse me, the bill, not the amendment. And we have, where are they? Okay, four sets of minutes, December 16th, December 14th, way back to May 4th, and April 30th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwald moves those four amendments. And, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendments are adopted, and by the way, we have two new pages this year. Sarah Kramer is over on the right there, wave. She's from Owatonna, and we have Luke Ferguson from Minneapolis right there. So welcome to the committee, and the meeting is adjourned.